Welcome to Healthcare Crossroads, a podcast showcasing the connections we make in healthcare data, compliance, and patient care. We are at a crossroads in healthcare. Let's make an impact by bringing together physicians, nurses, healthcare information management professionals, and legal experts in healthcare. Everyone in healthcare intersects. Let's find out how. This is Healthcare Crossroads. Here is your host, Jennifer McNamara.
Welcome, everyone, to the Healthcare Crossroads podcast. We are live today, and I am very excited to showcase, again, the connections that we make in healthcare and data and compliance, patient care. And I have a very special guest here today. I have John Piaskowski. Did I say that right, John?
You did. Very well done.
Excellent. That was my goal here today, is to pronounce your name right. And of course, to have this awesome conversation with you. We are here today to talk about the fine tuning of our specialties. Now, we each have our expertise, right? And so I thought we could start out with orthopedics today. What do you think?
Really? Orthopedics?
Yeah.
You know I hate orthopedics.
Cardio, no, I remember you saying that now. I probably should have reworded that. But you know, it's my baby, so it's my show. I'm going to talk about it today. But I know you have your favorites as well. John, what do you like to code?
I'm all cardio. That's my baby as well. So I guess I can deal with you doing orthopedics.
Well, we'll share the love. You know, I think in our previous conversations, we talked about how orthopedics and cardiology have their nuances, and we each have what we love about them. And then maybe we can learn from each other here, and our listeners can also learn about that. And then we'll, of course, talk about some other little areas that come off of that. Some of these specialties, you know, it's crazy. They have their little offshoots, I call them. They're like second cousins, so to speak, because orthopedics has podiatry, and there's other offshoots like your spine specialist. And then cardiology has their little nuance as well. What are some of the kind of, I guess I would say, offshoots of cardiology that branch out that you can think of?
Well, there's electrophysiology, which deals with heart rhythms. You have your cardiothoracic surgery, which deals with the heart structures and mm-hmm. of that nature. You have vascular, especially which isn't cardiac in nature, but deals with all the vessels related to the heart. And there's a few other ones. Interventional radiology deals with radiographics of the heart and the vessels, as amongst other things. Also ortho related in a little bit of an aspect.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So I think it's great when we can talk about this, but before we get into our conversation today, John, I want to get our listeners to get to know you a little bit better. I always ask my guests to tell me about themselves, so feel free to share what you feel. But John, tell us, you know, where you're from and how long you've been in healthcare. What do you do?
Oh, all right. So I'm in New Jersey. I've been in healthcare since 2008, 2009. I've been coding all of that time, coding and documentation. I actually got my start doing physical therapy. Spent 2 years in that, but then I switched over to a heart and lung hospital, did a lot of work with documentation, and then spread out into general surgery, spread out again into more cardiac specialties, urology, gastroenterology, orthopedics. I am certified in orthopedics, but left it because it's one of the most complicated specialties out there. But I currently work in a handful of hospitals. I work for Capital Health in New Jersey. I work part-time at a pediatric heart center in California. I also do a lot of work with the APC, and I do a lot of other offhand consulting.
That's amazing. You know, I feel like we're kind of in that same boat, you know, but I will tell you, you just said that orthopedics to you is one of the most complex out there. And I feel that way about cardiology myself. And I guess it's just, you know, when you do it for so long, it becomes just secondhand, right? Yeah. And so you're thinking about that, but I love it probably as much as like you like, you know, cardiology. So that's the goal today, is kind of talk about these areas and things that our listeners can benefit from as far as just understanding documentation, right? The basics that we can look at that will help us in any specialty. So let's talk about first anatomy, right? We love it, right? What do we love about anatomy so much? What are some of the things that both cardio and ortho can benefit from when it comes to anatomy? What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of anatomy. It's everywhere. And it's not one big unit. It's always broken down into little divisions, and knowing those divisions is what you need to do in order to code your surgeries or any kind of procedure or know what's going on. There's a lot of minutia that you can get help from by just doing some Google searching or getting familiar with anatomy. There's so many things that, and this is the reason why I have such a distaste for orthopedics, is because they have so many named anatomical positions within the bones, and for anatomical reference, they can get very hairy. There's a notch, you know, the woman when they're talking about the antecubital fossa, and then next minute they're talking about the ulnar notch. So now I have to reference one point to the next, and sometimes you can lose yourself. And I see that happen with cardiology, but it's a little easier for me because I'm so used to it. And I think that's what the problem is. We're not familiar with what we're looking at.
Right.
And sick practice. And some people aren't really geared up for the practice. And, you know, they look at it and get scared right away. And I ran away running from orthopedics for that reason.
I love it. Well, you know, hopefully we can kind of each bring to the table some things that we enjoy, of course. One of the things I will say that just from being a consultant for orthopedics myself, and when I'm auditing, I do find sometimes that there are issues with just the words distal and proximal in general, understanding the anatomical terms that way. But in times we also see some structures that have similar names, right? Like for in the spine, we see cervical, but we have to be careful because there's another cervical out there and we don't want to mix those areas up. And I work in plastic surgery sometimes with general surgery in the breast. And I will tell you one issue that we often see misinterpreted is the axilla. And there are codes, right, for the axilla that have to do with the musculoskeletal area. And there's also those that have to do with the breast tissue. So those are things in that specialty that I will kind of sometimes have to educate on, not to confuse those and think that just because they're doing the breast that you think, oh, that's the shoulder area, that's the axilla under the armpit, like it's a musculoskeletal thing. No, it's a breast tissue thing. And so it's very, you'd be very careful when you're looking at these things. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, it happens a lot too with cardiology. You deal a lot with named vessels and things that are what we call, I think they call them look-alike sanalikes, LASAs. You know, so being familiar with what those are, like there's one that I always use get confused with in the heart area. When you're looking at an image of the chest, there's a part of the esophagus, or the esophagus called the cardia, not related to heart whatsoever.
It's absolutely not, right?
It's so when you're looking at it and you're you know, if you don't look at it close enough, you see cardiac, you don't see cardia. So now you have to really pay attention because that's all gastric. And things like that can confuse you. And that's where you have to train your eye to know what things are. You know, the ostea kind of sounds orthopedic. You think ostea sounds bone. No, the ostea is the opening to any vessel. So when you see that, you have to make sure that you reference this is now vascular and not orthopedic.
Absolutely. And since we're on, you know, we're talking about our cardiology today as well, I wanted to kind of talk about some of my favorite procedures when I do get to code cardiology, and maybe you can kind of talk about these as well. I do like coding for the coronary procedures, those stents there. And I actually really enjoy digging into the hierarchy there of those vessels. And I think it's really important. I always had diagrams in front of me to make sure I understood, you know, the diagonals and all of that, where they fall and when to use the 2-8 and the 2-9 code. So what are some tips you maybe can offer in that area so people can kind of understand that hierarchy there or that structure of those PCIs there?
Well, what's helpful is having images ready. There's a lot of ways you can find images of the structure where you can pair them at once. You don't just want to view one vessel. You want to see where it is on an image in reference to the rest of them. Appendix L in the CPT book is one you can have at hand, and it's included with the CPT. But if you do have some extra funds available, there are other images you can purchase that you can have at hand when you're coding them, because it's good to have a visual reference when you're reading op note, because op notes are like a book. They're telling a story, to give a narrative, and being able to visualize a narrative just like any other novel is going to be important. And until you're familiar with understanding what's happening, those pictures are going to be your key to improving as a coder.
Absolutely.
I actually keep my own handy as well. I'm a big fan of Z Health, and
me too. Yeah,
they make these great anatomical references that you can use, and they are quite affordable. But if you're doing cardiac, and I think for orthopedics there are some out there as well. Like you can buy or you could go on Google and you can look at images of mm-hmm. any limb.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a marketing site I use called Canva, and there's so many images there. I use, of course, in my website, my WordPress site, I have so many images I can use for my education and teaching. And then the AAPC actually has a really great anatomy course that that we offer too, because I think it's important to break down each specialty when you're learning how to code, because you never know where you're going to go. And that's why I always tell coders is you may love where you're at, but what if you're in a hospital system and they just throw a specialty at you and say, code this? It's important to not be afraid of a challenge. And that's really where I went with my career, is I never was afraid of a challenge. So when they threw general surgery at me, when I'd been in orthopedics for so long, I was like, okay, let's figure this out. I can do this. And it worked. And now I love general surgery. So I never shied away from a challenge, but at the same time, you have to do the research and you have to know, but we also have to know what we have to know, not just the coding, but the billing and the payment structure. How important is NCCI for these specialties?
Well, NCCI is very important because there's a lot of overlap mm-hmm. in everything. You know, orthopedics is going to be no different than general surgery, than cardiology. When you have complicated injuries, like we see it a lot with kids, when they have an arm fracture that's, you know, in the lower arm, the upper arm, and at the elbow, we have to make sure that we understand that when there's a dislocation and there's a fracture at the same site, you can only cut one, unless there's some weird circumstances, like there's like one fracture the lower arm, one of the upper arm, and they're technically two different surgical fields. Mm-hmm. There are allowances given for that, and the same with cardiology. Like you have multiple vessel injuries. If you treat each one, you can code this separately unless indicated otherwise. There are some times when you have an AMI, an acute myocardial infarction, you can only code one service, regardless of how many vessels you treat. But if it's not if they're not currently having an infarction, then you code for each vessel. So just knowing mm-hmm. these ins and outs is what you have to do. So the NCCI manual, in addition to the NCCI a code set, you know, the ones that tell you if you can use modifier 59 or not. There is each year CMS releases their NCCI manual, which gives specific guidance, you know, in those on situations and what the rules are related to that. And that's where if you know where to find the information as to when you can code mobile fractures at the same site or mobile vessels in cardiology, that information will be at hand in the NCCI manual, whatever a chapter you're working on. And it is broken down by each individual chapter in CPT. So you're looking at orthopedics area for orthopedic mm-hmm. guidance, and the cardiology chapter for cardiology guidance. And just knowing that is going to help you choose the right code each time.
Absolutely. I live in chapter 4 for orthopedics. It's like, I always say, check chapter 4, know it well. But I will say too, you know, with Medicare, you know, if you look and you're looking for LCD policies, right? We have to understand the importance of LCD policies when it comes to making sure the diagnosis matches the procedure we're doing, and they have that. But there's some great actual coding guidance within that. If you actually pull up what I was talking about earlier with those coronary interventions, there's a great policy there from Medicare that gives you straightforward criteria. You can do this in this situation, or you can do this in this situation. And so knowing that very well is important. And regardless of what specialty you're doing, if there's a policy on it, you're going to get some really great coding guidance and documentation guidance from Medicare. They really give you everything on a silver platter, I think, when it comes to what you need to document, what you need to, you know, what you're limited by and what your coverage guidelines are. So I think it's important that as a practice, you know that information and you share it with your physicians and you share it with your team. So everyone is on the same page and you can have an efficient, you know, revenue stream. Because it's not just about coding, right? It's about getting paid, right?
Yeah. And one thing to know it's important is there's the LCDs, there's the NCDs, and there's also billing documents. So mm-hmm. all your diagnosis codes that are applied to each procedure code, if there are certain allowances and things they don't allow for, you're going to want to go to the billing document, which is going to tell you which diagnosis code aligns with this procedure. So mm-hmm. that's information they don't have in the LCD, but right. having both those at hand is important too. I have pages and pages of things that's printed out, and they're all like 35 pages. Right. So like, unless you want to go through a lot of paper, make sure you link them, put them on in your bookmark, right. because those are large files, because it's every diagnosis code listed in order that's payable for certain procedures. And I see a lot with the ones related to interventions, like when you do an aortogram and other vascular grams of the limbs, they actually tell you what's reasonable to be paid for, and here's the list of all the diagnoses that apply, mm-hmm. and the ones that don't apply. So if you're using a diagnosis code that's not on the list, it's most likely going to get denied.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree 100%. And you mentioned earlier about the 59 modifier. So we have that PTP edit file where you have those edit pairs that hit each other, and you're allowed to, of course, append a modifier. If those indicators say yes, you can bypass with a modifier. But I really encourage everyone to dig out, since Medicare kind of runs the show with a lot of this and a lot of payers follow that NCCI process, to look at their document when they discuss examples of proper use of 59. Especially when it comes to the when it says that you can put it on additional sites, right? When it's a non-contiguous site, they talk about, right? So that word may not be familiar to everyone. So it means these sites that are not adjoining on a boundary, or they consist of parts that adjoin. So that's the difference between them. So if it's a contiguous site, your parts are going to be really kind of joining together. So we see this a lot in the foot, which I know we love to talk about the feet, right? We love the feet, don't we? I won't go there too much, but that's just a good example. And there's plenty of examples in that document, and we'll put it in our show notes, everyone, so you can have it as a quick reference. So you can actually go and make sure you know that well. Know what Medicare says about that separate site. What is their interpretation of that?
Yeah, there's also a lot there's a lot of allowances as to what defines a different site. Is there a new incision? Is an injury that can be considered a separately identifiable, like a fracture.
Right.
Technically, if you're, I know for orthopedics, there's a rule that if you can treat one fracture with one cast, it's one code. Mm-hmm. So if they have multiple fractures in one area, one cast applied, it's only one fixation. Right. But if they have to do something more complex, like put in a pin, in addition to placing the cast or splinting, then you start having to look at the NCCI manual and seeing if it truly is, it does allow for a modifier 59. And it happens with, mm-hmm. happens with a lot, especially a lot of general mm-hmm. surgeries when you have like a major injury, and there's bleeding, mm-hmm. there's a leg break. Can you code for the ligation of the vessels? No, you can't. If you're doing any kind of closure, that's included.
Right.
These things that you'll find out by reading the NCCI manual, they have a lot of general rules. Mm-hmm. Any kind of closure, any kind of controlled bleeding, you can't get paid for at the same field. It's understood you're going to close it, that you're going to stop it. If you don't, well, you're going to hurt the patient. So they understand these incidental.
Bad medicine.
Yeah, exactly. Malpractice suit waiting to happen.
Exactly.
They give a list of things that are included. Anything you have to do in order to complete that service is also included. Mm-hmm. And I see this a lot with pediatrics. Like when they do open sternal procedures, you have to move the thymus. A lot of times it's take it right out. You can't bill for that because you need to take the thymus out in order to open the chest plate to get to the heart. Mm-hmm. These kind of things you would have to find out the hard way by reading the NCCI manual or any kind of procedure that has indication CPT. That is, it is a separate procedure. You have to look and see, is it truly separate or mm-hmm. is it something that's included in the major surgery that I'm also doing?
Right. You have to know your procedure, right? You have to know what they normally would do. I know I'm one of those, I love my books. And so when I teach, I say, don't rely on your encoders, but encoders can be nice with those lay terms to kind of help us kind of walk us through that process of that procedure. So it's helpful, right? You mentioned what you just talked about. It made me think of spine because we have this little caveat when it comes to doing the laminectomies with the arthrodesis that we have to with the spine, because there's a difference between actually doing it for decompression and doing it just to prepare the inner space. So you have to do that, right? In order to prepare that space, you need to get that out of the way. But there are times where there's a specific purpose for it. And so you have to know the rules and your payer, how they interpret that. So I won't go into that. That's another hour discussion on the spine. But that's the thing to think about, right? When we think about that. Recently, I was able to attend HealthCon in Denver. And I attended this session that was put on by someone who is at the AMA. And he gave some really great tips, just basic things going back to the beginning of using your books. And I want to just point this out real quick. Just understanding the description of your CPT code will help you tremendously. Everything that is included in that procedure code is in the description for the most part. And they have those little parentheses, right? They'll say IE or it's EG. So one of those means examples, and another one, it's basically anything in that parentheses, that's all it is. So you want to make sure and look at those parentheses in those codes. If they give you examples, e.g., it doesn't mean that's an all-inclusive list. I use this in podiatry a lot, right? Because sometimes they'll give examples of an arthrodesis procedure. There's different ways to repair the foot. And they give you examples, but it doesn't mean that's all the only reason to use that code, right? So we want to be careful about, you know, drawing conclusions from that, those examples, that that's all you can use it for. When you learn the language that is given in AMA CPT book, then you're going to be able to interpret those correctly. I'm sure there's examples, of course, in cardiology like that as well.
Oh yeah, there is. I mean, one of the things that we see a lot with cardiology coding is there's a with or without a statement in the CPT. So if it's done or if it isn't, it's included in that a service. So just because right. they don't, you know, they may not do it, it doesn't mean they have to do the modifier 52. Whether they do it or not, it's all the same rate. And if they do it, you're not able to use it as an add-on code because it's included in the service you did. So if you do something like an excision of, excision of an embolus, and then you go and you do mechanical thrombectomy, well, there's a statement in that CPT code that is with or without that mechanical thrombectomy. So right. if you do through that same decision, you can't bill for it. And unfortunately, that's the way it is, that it is built into that code and you're paid for it regardless of whether or not you have to do it.
Right, exactly. Now, you know, I know we love talking about CPT, but I thought we could switch a little bit and talk about some of the ICD-10 challenges that we have when it comes to orthopedics and maybe in cardiovascular as well. So, with most specialties, we have this seventh character. A lot of them use it, whether it's a complication or other area where we have to use this diagnosis, right? So there's a lot of options for seventh characters. What are some of the things that you have seen that have been challenging?
Well, with orthopedics, you want to start with that because that's where a lot of the heavy work is with the seventh character. And, you know, it's one of the ones that are in the S area of the CPT or the ICD-10 book, and the mm-hmm. And T is where you use a lot of the seventh character, as well as the external causes. But right. knowing whether it's an open fracture, whether it's closed, whether it's initial service, whether it's follow-up, like being able to determine where they are in their care and what kind of injury it is really where you have to look at the documentation. And sometimes that's where you lose me. And or even before you get, I'm already lost. I've already thrown my hands up there and quit and walked away.
You're like, I'm done.
Yeah, all right, I give up. But you can. You know, if you're gonna do the coding, you know, you You can't let these little things get you. But knowing what those designations are, like I can explain off the top of my head what difference between A and S is, or A and D is. The A, the seventh carry indicates that it's a new injury and they're not yet in the healing stage. You're in the active in the active treatment. Whereas when they're in the D area, they're in the healing stage. But knowing when that begins is where I have a hard time. If they're in the hospital for 28 days, when does that switch over from active care versus healing care? That's where I think you know better than I.
Yeah, you know, it's a challenge because, you know, every encounter would stand alone. So it really just depends on, as we know, in the professional fee world, every encounter stands alone. So we rely on that documentation from the provider to make that clear to us. But typically, in my world, when I see a patient, you know, that has surgery, they come in the office and they are officially stepping into the post-operative treatment, right? But the minute they have a complication, they have to go back to the OR, that now becomes an active treatment again. So it really just depends on what they're doing for them that day. Are they really just following them up? It can go from a D to an A again very, very quickly because of the nature of what needs to be done. And so that's always a constant watching back and forth as to what's happening to the patient. Where are they at in their treatment? Because they can go from being in the healing phase to having a re-injury. Now they go back into the active treatment phase. And maybe it's the same area. Maybe it's a new fracture of that same area. But we have to watch those things. And sometimes within one note, you can have a D and an A because they're being followed up for this one. But then they're, of course, they have this new injury and this is actually an active treatment. So it's a constant, you know, watching there of that. When I'm coding too, I noticed something years ago with ICD-10 that I wanted to bring out to people that sometimes gets missed is those boxes, the ICD-10 seventh character boxes in your book. You may not readily see them, of course, as clearly in your encoders. So that's why it's important to look at the book. At the beginning of each little box that tells you the seventh character, it gives you a category that box belongs to. And it's very, very easy to use the wrong seventh character if you don't read those instructions because it's so close to that code set and you don't read it carefully. It says, these seventh characters only apply to this three-digit category. And then you have to go back to the beginning of that category to find the correct, you know, box that tells you these are the seventh characters for these categories. It happens so often, you would not believe how many times we have denials because the wrong seventh character was used.
I mean, this is a situation where, like, you can possibly take that part of the CBT and kind of blow it up, print it out, and then when you're doing the op note and you're at the point where you're like, why? You have the image on your ceiling. Like, when your head's pounding and you're just throwing your head up in frustration, just staring right down at you. Like, you know, and I think that's what I have. I used to have all these things like plaster my wall, table risk, and all of the elopenics. I used to have things everywhere, which is like an awkward because each situation, like I found myself in different degrees of exasperation where I'd be like, okay, so this one, I'd be like head pounding, looking down, and there's my table risk. And then another situation would put me where I'm like patting my head on my desk and at my feet, there's the appendix L. So like whatever makes it easiest for you. But I think having some visual at hand whenever you need it is actually gonna be key as well.
No, I agree with you. And you know, I have done my best to learn that appendix L when I'm teaching that part of the CPC exam to my students. And I have used it in the past, but I also have used some stuff from Z-Health because it's just helpful. Sometimes it's easier to look at multiple diagrams of that to interpret that where you're at first, second, or third. It's really hard sometimes to find it visually with your eyes. So you have to spend time like reviewing those images to make sure you know where they fall into which order. And so I think sometimes it's there, but maybe our eyes just glaze over and we're like, where is it? I know it's here somewhere. You're trying to find the specific area you're looking for. That was my problem initially. It's just my eyes would just glaze over. Maybe it's because I just turned 40 now and I'm like, my vision is going, but like it takes me so much longer to find things visually than it used to.
And again, When you're reading Omno and your eyes get glazed over, that's the time you have to get up and just take a breather.
Yes.
Orthopedics does that. Like the hardest thing I have, like you're reading it and they're going over and they're reading through it, and they do it in a linear fashion. They go from point A to point B. But sometimes they flip flop back and forth. They go from point A to point C to point B to point X, and then they're back at the beginning again because they're treating multiple things at the same time. Just being able to kind of keep track of that. There's a lot of highlighting, underlining, putting notations. And sometimes if you have to mark up the note, just make sure you know what's going on. Don't be afraid. Print it out. Take off the patient's name. Just put it in the key text. And just kind of try to follow along, piece together like a puzzle. Sometimes you get the provider that makes it easy for you. Sometimes you get the case where there's no way for them to do that for you. They do their best with what they have, augmentation-wise. And if you do have questions, always reach out. Send a query. Don't ever try to figure out if you're not sure, ask.
Absolutely. I've learned so much from my surgeons over the years, and some of them I still talk to, and they give me quotes from my articles because we've built this relationship, and not being afraid to ask them those questions because they love to talk about what they do. I mean, that's their passion. Their passion is their patients and what they do for a living. It's their passion. And so for us, if we're passionate about coding, it's going to filter over to us. They're going to see our passion, and that our goal really is to get them paid. And we need help sometimes from them. We need to get their assistance here. One thing we're talking about, of course, these seventh characters, and it is what we call a coding convention, right? There are several conventions in ICD-10, these basic things that we have to know when we're interpreting guidelines. There's one that I talked about earlier, John. It was the and or guideline. Yeah. So what do we need to know about that to kind of clear things up for us?
All right. So the and or isn't like the usual, you wouldn't use it in the same aspect you use a normal everyday conversation. The and or is, if they use the word and, it's included as well. Mm-hmm. It's understood that it's actually an inherent part of. And there's not many codes where I could actually talk about this. But I think one of the examples is, diverticulitis has an element where you have diverticulitis with an abscess and perforation. Mm-hmm. So they use the word and to equal or. So, and that's weird to understand. So if they have an abscess and they have an aspiration, or they have an abscess and perforation, it's understood that there's a perforation. Or they don't have it. You know, it's and or. So they, if you're looking at documentation, and because of how complex these diagnostic codes, in order to limit them from having 85 different diverticulitis codes, they combine them and merge them.
Right.
And use specification in order to save space, we're going to say, if they have the abscess and they have the perforation, or one of those two, we'll accept this code.
Right.
So being able to know that when they say and or in the code description, it's one or the other, or both. They don't have to have both of them.
Exactly.
Or perforation, or they can have both of them. And that's how you code it. And that's sometimes hard to comprehend. When I first started, I was like freaking out. Like, there's no code that describes this patient's condition. How do I code it? And I didn't really understand that the and or meant that in that aspect. And I think there's kind of aligns with the width. And I don't want to go too heavy in the width because then that's another monster.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yes. And I preach that a lot with when I do value-based care education with diabetes. I'm always talking about it. Actually, it was funny. I had a conversation with an organization recently, and some physicians were asking some questions and this is really interesting, I thought, from their aspect, from a clinician's, you know, headspace, is they're afraid to do all these different codes because to them, they don't think that linking these two things together all the time is appropriate for that patient. So to them, connecting those two conditions automatically, it's a block in their brain. Like they can't justify it with ICD-10. So we have to kind of get around that and remind them that these are the guidelines we live in, and these particular guidelines are linked to how things are reimbursed or how, especially with risk adjustment, how that is valued. So the combination codes raise that risk to the patient. So we tell them, if you, for instance, feel that these two conditions should not be linked, please identify that, because our guidelines inform us that the only way to not link them is for provider documentation to clearly state that they are not related.
Yeah. And I see that a lot with the hypertension, kidney disease, yep. heart failure. I'm so used to telling them if they're together, I'm under the impression that they're connected, unless you tell me they're not. And yep. that's when it gets hairy, because a lot of patients, like you said, with diabetes, I see a lot of patients that have diabetes with the hypertension, and those connect with the width function. Right. And they have heart failure, and they have kidney disease. The kidney disease is connected to the diabetes. The kidney disease is related to the hypertension. The kidney disease is related to the heart failure. And next thing you know, your nose is bleeding because there's so many different, like everything is like one big jumbled mess. But ICD-10 gives us the allowance to code them all as related, because there's really no way to tell if they're not. You know, there are situations where, you know, okay, a patient comes in and they have pancreatitis and they have hypoglycemia, but they also have diabetes. So what's causing the hypoglycemia? Is it the fact that they have an infection in their pancreas, or because they were born with type 1 diabetes? That's when you have to query the provider, because now you have two causes. You don't have to do that if with a lot of clinicians that use the width in the ICD-10 description, you just code them and we walk away and move on, because that's just the way we're allowed to do it. And it's not like practicing medicine. You know, the AMA says you can do it, and you can do it because it's a way that the AMA panel, who are doctors, by the way, have decided this is the right thing to do. So if your provider feels this is incorrect, well, then they need to be more specific. If they don't want you to code it that way, then they have to give you a reason not to. Because then if they're not, then we're being forced to code it incorrectly.
Absolutely. No, I 100% agree. I think this is great, great stuff for our listeners. Maybe sometimes we think we have to get back to the basics sometimes, because we've been doing this so long, our brains are just clouded over with all this information, and we forget to get back to the basics of just these individual conventions that really change the game and affect reimbursement. And I will say, if you saw the post that I recently posted, I wanted to make sure everyone was aware. It's been happening for years, but commercial payers in their policies have indicated they are looking at conventions. When they create denials for certain things, they are looking at these coding conventions now a lot more closely, because we know value-based care is becoming more popular, and it's really about the quality. The diagnosis is really being tracked for the payment, you know, in the future. So we want to make sure that we're on top of these guidelines. Now, something we talked about too was when these specialties have to sometimes go out of their scope. Now, I know when I worked in general surgery, for instance, we would have to code from the 30,000 series codes for those catheters. Sometimes were the vascular catheters. What are some examples that you can think of where your orthos and your cardios have to go outside of their scope sometimes?
Major trauma. And you know, a lot of these are trauma related. I've always had, and I don't want to sound being insensitive to this, but I've always wanted to see surgery. There's like, I have a list of things that by the time I'm old and retired, I would like to see at least coded once. One of those was heart massage. You know, patient, poor soul, comes into the ER and they actually have to have the doctor open them up and massage the heart to keep it pumping. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that's something I think would be interesting to see. But the related condition with that, you know, to get to the heart, and I see it's a little other case, you have to open the sternum and you have to break bones and you have to be able to put them back together, because you're the one doing this. There may not be an orthopedist on hand to do this for you at the time. Right. So there's means more lab. There's a lot of issues, a lot of times when you have to take into account like what the bones are related to. Mm-hmm. Orthopedics have to deal with this as well, because they have a potential that right next to every bone is a major artery or is a major vein, and you mess that up and patient is going to have an internal hemorrhage. You have to fix. So you also know how to do closure of any kind of vessels or do ligation or control bleeding. That's part of the job. So what happens, sometimes patient comes in and they do an exploration of an injury. Exploration codes, which I think are like a 200000 something. those include any control bleeding, any removal of any any foreign bodies. It's like a one piece close all, like capture all code for anything we have to do to, you know, to resolve the trauma. And again, there's NCCI bundles that said if you're doing any kind of fracture, there's controlled bleeding. If it's an open vessel, you have to make sure. So a lot of times there is overlap. Can we cope the overlap? Sometimes we can, sometimes we can't.
Mm-hmm.
I work with the cardio. Every once in a while, he has to go in and he has to close the rib cage. Like he'll have to go in and make sure that there's no infection, make sure that it's closed. Like they don't close it right away, which is weird if you're a pediatric patient like 6 days old.
Yeah.
Just leave it open. They'll still, it's like they wrap them in saran wrap, say we'll come back in 3 days and look at you. And I'm not trying to be like insensitive. Sometimes that happens where they don't want to close because if they have to reopen, that's more injury or higher risk to the patient having to, you know, close the bones and reopen them again. Sometimes they just leave them open because in the worst case scenario, they have to get in there right away and they don't have a minute to spare. And the risk is let's just leave it open because there's a high anticipation it's going to happen.
Right.
I've seen with leg fractures where they have a very severe dislocation. The dislocation of the kneecap has impacted that femoral artery. They move one wrong direction either way, they're going to severely damage that leg vessel, which supplies all the blood to your lower extremity.
Absolutely.
And I think there was one episode of this one TV show, Grey's Anatomy, years ago, where the guy
Grey's Anatomy, oh my gosh.
And he fixed, I don't know if it was Grey's Anatomy or House, but he went in, he went in, jumped the gun, and reset, you know, he realigned the kneecap. The guy was a foot player, severely ruptured the femoral artery, and the guy didn't able to walk again.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that it's not funny, but I mean, like these TV shows, you know, I'm sure they have consultants that talk about these things. They're obviously not medically trained, but I like watching them just for the fact. I'm like, I want to see what they're doing. And like my HIPAA brain always kicks in like, oh my goodness, compliance issues all over the place with these shows. Oh my gosh, it cracks me up. But no, you can learn a lot just, you know, from what they're doing when you know what should happen. But again, also, I think there's so many surgeons out there that are such, they're so, you know, involved in making sure the patient has good outcomes. So they're always thinking about these variables, right? They're thinking about things that could happen, which is why they do the best they can, right, to plan to have these co-surgeries, these situations where they're going to have somebody available to be there to be that co-surgeon, team surgery sometimes with these trauma situations to where they need multiple surgeons involved to make sure the patient has a good outcome, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So one last thought that I wanted to talk about, and this is something that I always see that I think is so important when we're reading op notes, is understanding just what is actually happening and what is documented. Sometimes it's there and maybe we're not trained enough. We need a little more education onto what we're looking at. The description at the top of the op note. I see so many times where the coding is obviously taken from there and there's so many missed opportunities that have been captured in the body of the op note, which is where we should code from. So what are some things that you've seen, maybe some tips you can give our audience on being careful with when you're coding from those descriptions?
It's not there. There are no headers. It's like reading the table of contents.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Skip right past it. Fast forward that bad boy to the meat.
Yes, the meat. It's
really kind of a waste of, I don't want to say waste of time, but it's information you're not going to really use anyway. It's more confirmatory.
Yeah.
If they conflict, CMS says what's in the body of the report matters, not what's in the header.
Right.
Which sometimes is really scary because sometimes in the headers they say that patient came in with a left leg dislocation or left knee dislocation, and the body is like they're saying right.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have to use that because that information is what is understood to be correct, not in the heading. And if that could be a major problem, then that's when you'd have to query.
Yeah.
But the key information is in the body report. And if you're not using that, that's a compliance risk because if you're wrong, if that header is wrong and you code from the header, you're wrong. A plus B equals wrong coding. And I would see that a lot as a way for people It's a way for people to get through other coding quickly. It's an awful way of cutting corners. You know what happens when you cut corners? And I strongly advise against it. If you read the op note and you don't understand it, practice yeah. when you, in your off time. I know people don't say, well, my off time is my off time. But this is your livelihood. Take the extra time, take the initiative. You know, when you do get, if you do go for certifications, you're doing the certification in your off time. You're not doing it in your paid hours. So consider this in that same situation. And again, if the op note isn't clear, that's when you Google. That's when you look at images. That's when you try to draw it out. Like, if you are following in that narrative, have pen and paper ready. Make notes. Kind of like, until you're at the point where you can create a visual in your head, make the visual.
Right.
There's going to be anatomical reference. You draw it out. You try to, like, picture what's happening. And then you compare that to what the CPT code is. Or what the injury is. You know, this will help you determine if this is a class one, what are some fracture types. Like, you know, it'll help you compare it to what's in the Merck manual, what the AMA defines as a green stick fracture, a spiral fracture. Right. Does it get the extra, like, what is the seventh character I would apply? What is the CPT code? Is this one code or is it two? Because there's it's a compound a fracture of the radius and ulna. Radius and ulna are one code for certain fixations. Sometimes they're not. But having an image at hand, and if you can't read the note, if you can't read the op note and make a picture, that's when you need to do some research. You have to maybe understand the anatomy better, speak to the provider. If you have access to the images, if they take radiology and those images in their hand, look at them, and then read the op note and make comparisons. So if he's saying that there is a 1 millimeter hairline fracture just above the distal ulna, look at the image in the ICD-10 book and a CPT in that orthopedics chapter, they have images. Contrast and compare. You know, these are reference books, and their references are usually spot on because they're the most common procedures usually have images applied to them.
Absolutely. And I was going to say here, we have a comment from Lori, my girl at CCO, and she has a free PDF for abstracting from an op note to help coders. So we'll put that in our show notes. So we'll definitely get that over to everyone so they have access to that. CCO has some great resources, and you know, we of course try our best at Ozark Institute to make as much education available as possible with our courses. Podcast is a great way to get that education. We have articles we put out on different things. I recently just posted a brief update on one of the crazy major changes to hernia coding coming in 2023. If you're in general surgery, y'all need to be paying attention to what is happening with those changes. And later this month, we're in October. Next month, in November, we're going to have a webinar on the CPT changes. We're going to include some of that hernia stuff, some examples. And so I hope everyone can join us for that webinar. Go to ozarkinstitute.oncospark.com and make sure that you are, of course, linked there for us. And I know you mentioned earlier you don't like the feet. I'm going to tell you, I have one I don't like, and that's the hands. I'm not a fan of the hands.
I can agree with that as well because there's way too many bones. AMA, there's too many bones in a hand.
Yeah.
We need to find a way to fix this.
Yeah, I don't know if they can do that, if they can change the bones. I'm not sure. But hey, we'll see. But no, I love it. I love it. This is great. And I'm going to tell you, if you're one of those people that doesn't like hands like me, I'm going to shout out to my girl, Jessica Burke. She's my go-to. She spoke on hands at our orthopedic conference earlier this year. And you can catch her on October 20th on Ozark Institute. We're going to have a webinar with our keynote speaker, Jessica Burke, on fracture care billing. I know we're all kind of on pins and needles waiting to see what happens with the global package in 2023. But until that time, we need to understand the fractured care billing, how things changed in 2022, how it affects us. So check that out on our website. John, thank you so much for joining today. It's been a pleasure to get to know you a little better and to talk ortho and cardio with you. So thank you for joining the Healthcare Crossroads podcast.
Thank you. And if anybody wants to reach out to me later and talk about cardio, just no ortho.
No.
I'll talk cardio with you. Just hands, feet, just leave that out of the conversation.
Absolutely. Well, we'll make sure that happens. And we'll put John's information in our show notes. You can connect with him on, of course, social media as well as through email. And so we'll make sure that everyone has access to talk to him. And thanks, John. Thanks again. Thanks to our listeners for joining always when we have these great live podcast episodes with our guests. And stay tuned for our next episode later this month. Thank you, as always, for listening to the Healthcare Crossroads podcast. I want to thank our sponsors over at OncoSpark for always helping us with our technology solutions. Thank you again, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for joining us this week on Healthcare Crossroads. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss a show. Thank you to our sponsors at OncoSpark. OncoSpark is a technology-enabled revenue cycle management company. They help you effectively manage claims data with technology solutions. Check out their website to learn more at www.oncospark.com. Thank you, OncoSpark.